please the court. And seeing no substitute Rule 13 student to handle my argument, my name is Tim Monsees, ladies and gentlemen. And this is must be my second time here after 30-some years. So
welcome back.
It's a pleasure. Your Honors, this is a case that I know has a level of factual complexity, and that, I think, has clouded what are really, at its essence, very simple legal issues from the start, beginning in the trial court. At its very core, at its very heart, all this is a case where my client, Mr. Nail, had certain contractual rights that he went to Hush Blackwell and said, I think these are at risk. I need somebody to step in and do everything they can to protect these rights on my behalf. There was a sale of the company in which he held some stock option agreements, and those stock option agreements, because of the merger, he was concerned that now that the person who had those rights from which he could exercise was going to squander them. There was certainly at least an anticipation of breach. And that is why he went to Hush Blackwell. He was at Hush Blackwell before there was any downturn in the market, and certainly inherent in that contractual obligation and that representation obligation with Hush Blackwell was to protect the value of these stocks. He was told, and I think the record has instances, I don't think this is an issue in the record, he was told that that case, frankly, had little of any practical value because Hush Blackwell did not recognize at the time that some restrictions imposed on the back of the stock certificates in the new publicly traded United Kingdom Corporation, they got misguided, misdirected into believing, in spite of the fact that they had a London office, never consulted with that London office, that those restrictive legends had an impact restricting the transfer of those individual shares. Accordingly, they told Mr. Nail, look, you know, you can file a lawsuit, but you're not going to get anything because these restrictive legends are going to restrict your ability to transfer. And by the time this period...
Well, Hush says it was restricted anyway by Mr. Mueller's already having signed the agreement. So
I'm sorry, Judge?
As I understood it, isn't there a... Mr. Mueller had already signed the agreement by that point, precluding transfer anyway. Is that correct?
That was done, it was done shortly, right at about the time or shortly after Mr. Nail retained Hush Blackwell. Okay, so there's a little bit of a dispute as to exactly when Mr. Mueller signed any agreement that would have restricted the transfer. But that's really not the issue, Judge. The issue is the stock option agreements were with Mr. Mueller. So Mr. Mueller is the one that had certain steps been taken would have put Mr. Mueller in breach of contract. And most of the doubts in this case, frankly, are because that was never done. If that's done or advised by Hush Blackwell, then the doubts that remain in this case as to what would have happened, would there have been a breach? Yes, because he most certainly would have breached that in light of all the money he was making by restricting those shares with the new corporation. Or, hope above hopes, he honors them, in which case my client realizes in excess of $10 million worth of options of stocks. So, I mean, I think
to what extent is Hush responsible for investment advice versus the Mr. Nail, who's apparently a sophisticated investor, can read the documents himself, and this is, to what extent is this an investment that may have gone awry or not awry, and Mr. Nail assumes responsibility himself versus the law firm who would give him advice?
I don't think Hush Blackwell has any responsibility to give investment advice, Judge. What I think they had a responsibility to do was, because this was a dynamic market, and it's not the fluctuation of the market that had to be protected, it was any fluctuation of one particular stock which was directly at the heart of the representation. And they should have recognized early on that if they had advised Mr. Nail to exercise those options or had filed suit on those options, you would have fixed a price And that thereafter, Mr. Nail would have had the benefit of that bargain, irrespective of what happened to the market.
But perhaps maybe they didn't want to do that, your client or the law firm, because there was an expectation that the price could have increased. Maybe an intervening cause would have had the reverse effect, a reverse 9/11 effect of causing an increased value in the stock. Then we wouldn't even be here, right?
Well, certainly, had the stock just continued to climb, it's axiomatic, Judge, that after this waiting time, sure, he could have exercised them, he would have made the money. The problem was, in any market, you're putting your client, in Hush Blackwell's case, you were putting your client bearing 100% of that risk.
But it wasn't for nothing. I mean, and I understand your argument, but the alternative the other side says is that you got something in the settlement agreement that you wouldn't otherwise have had. In addition to the $50,000, you got a five-year option. And so you weigh and balance that. How do we look back and second-guess the decisions made at that time?
Judge, I see this as precisely the same situation as if a client came to me who had been in a car wreck and had catastrophic injuries, and I get told by State Farm that they've got a $100,000 policy. And so I turn to my client and say, well, I realize you got a $3 million case, but you better take this $100,000 policy because that's all there is to get.
But where is your showing that you would have, had they tried to negotiate, had they sold the stock and then tried to negotiate a settlement, you would have gotten that same benefit? I mean,
well, the case was settled, Judge, because this man was given the advice that he really didn't have any practical alternative, that the underlying lawsuit, which represented the Blackwell, now retrospectively say that winning that breach of contract lawsuit was a no-brainer, that I would have rather had my side than the other side. You know, they settled what was that claim and never ventured into a lawsuit because Mr. Nail based his decision to settle that for what was a compromise sum based upon advice that his lawsuit was basically valueless. Retrospectively, that's not true.
But focus us on what the legal issues are versus these disputes as to the wisdom of exercising the options or not. So what should we determine is a disputed issue of fact, and what is an insufficiency or sufficiency of pleading to preclude summary judgment?
Well, Judge, as originally briefed and presented to the trial court, what was at issue predominantly, at least how I think we've arrived here, was through a misapplication of the Williams versus Preeman case. At the heart of the original briefing, there was really nothing regarding the case within a case. That wasn't what was really originally presented to the trial court. What was presented to the trial court was that Mr. Nail, in the application, and I think the wrongful application of the Williams versus Preeman case, saying that when he settled that case, that somehow we had a higher burden to show that was necessary to mitigate damages. I think I said so at the time, and I think even the longer I look at this, that Williams versus Preeman case has absolutely no application of the situation here because it applies to situations where people like Mr. Nail learn of the negligence of their attorney and then settle their case so that they then have the additional burden of proving mitigation of damages. And I think that was at the heart of the issue as originally presented to the trial court. It's morphed since that time. It morphed within the trial court's decision that somehow we had failed in our burden to show that we were going to win that underlying suit. And so, I mean, I think there's still evidence in the record presented to the trial court, presented to the Court of Appeals and here, saying that, yes, we would have won that case.
Well, why don't you have to show that you would have won that case?
Well, I think we do in terms of the ultimate submissibility of the case in the trial court. All I'm saying, Judge, is that really wasn't the issue that was presented to the trial court. It was presented in the context that we had failed the Williams versus
Preeman. I thought it was that you had no expert testimony to the effect that you would have won the case and therefore you'd failed to prove damages.
But that was not presented in the context of the case within a case argument, Judge. I mean, thereafter, we did present further evidence of that in our motion for rehearing, where we brought up, and we had the affidavit of our expert to clarify the opinions he had previously given. I think that was considered by the trial court, and she was allowed to do so within her discretion, and then rejected that as well on rehearing. We had in the record, and still have in the record, the testimony of Mr. Carman, who was the acting defendant to begin with, saying words of the effect that were clearly implied that he felt that the case was a winnable case, because he said, basically, I liked my case better than their case. Mr. Thompson, who was deposed as a representative of Hush Blackwell, said that the underlying case he characterized as a no-brainer. And the only thing that's lacking is how I think we got there to begin with. It was on the question of what were your damages, and the court seemed persuaded that we couldn't put a precise calculation on that, but I think the case law is replete that you don't have to show the measure of damages, you have to show the fact of damage. And we had ample evidence in the record that
because... But isn't that the whole heart of this? You're saying you would have had greater damages if you had exercised the options and then sued for breach of contract than you got out of the settlement agreement, and you're asking us to weigh and balance those very things?
Ultimately, Judge, because he was told to compromise, and there were further problems because of the documentation out of that compromise agreement, which are a whole separate issue in this lawsuit, but because he was told to compromise for conceptually 50 cents on the dollar of what his case was originally worth, and then because of further problems with that compromise, he was further delayed in his ability to exercise. He ultimately, out of what was in excess of $10 million worth of deals, recovered about $600,000 on stock options that at their peak value were worth in excess of $10 million. I mean, that's the case in a nutshell.
So is that how you establish the value of your loss settlement position? How do you establish the value of what you lost at the settlement?
Well, the loss settlement, the settlement agreement failed in two respects, Judge. Number one, Mr. Nail, once he finally accepted the advice of Hush Blackwell and said, okay, if you're telling me I've got no lawsuit, let's settle it, he said, look, whatever I'm going to be able to do to exercise these going forward, at least take Mr. Mueller out of the mix. Well, that essential request failed because of the improper paperwork.
But you stipulated that caused no damages.
It caused no damages in the back end, in the sense that
it, in fact, it caused a 2-week delay and there was no change in the stock price. That didn't cause any damages.
I understand that, Judge, but what it did was is it compromised ultimately because they applied Missouri law, because of the things that then went down in the Kansas court as he's trying to mitigate his damages against Mr. Mueller.
But please answer, what damage was caused by the $245 or whatever it was for the stamps and for a 2-week delay and getting one more piece of paper?
We're not here to say that the 2-week delay, what the trial court left us with was only the 2-week delay. And frankly, rather,
right.
frankly, the practical matter, rather than
But you
to
seem
keep,
to be talking and relying on that, so I'm curious why.
No, the essential damages are I compromised my lawsuit for an insignificant sum because you told me I didn't have any lawsuit because you got dissuaded and never figured out what the UK requirements were with respect to the transfer of these shares.
But you are relying on those requirements and they had no effect on this. So if we don't find the failure to, I mean, as I understand it, Mr. Mueller immediately signed the paper you wanted signed and there was no damage there. So,
but that also put Mr. Nail at risk going forward on transfers. I mean, let's put it this way. Who would trade in the stock market knowing that if I decide today I'm going to trade, I got to wait 3 weeks to find out what the value is before I find out whether that was a good decision to trade or a bad decision? Mr. Nail didn't want to be put in that position. And when he was put in that position, he also had to forego the negotiated right to an $8 million liquidated damage clause, which failed because the settlement agreement failed. So it was frankly, a comedy of errors that occurred, which began with bad advice over settle your lawsuit, which he did based on that incomplete advice. I see him.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
No further questions? Well, you'll have time on rebuttal. Thank you.
May I proceed, Your Honor?
You may proceed.
I do believe that there is a very significant legal issue that's presented to the court this morning. It is whether or not and how this court establishes the law of Missouri as to whether or not a plaintiff in a legal malpractice case is required to prove causation of injury and causation of damage by expert testimony. Now, while recognizing some possible exceptions for clear and palpable situations, the appellate courts of this case, of this state, I'm sorry, the appellate courts of this state, the courts of many jurisdictions, and the restatement third of lawyer conduct clearly require expert testimony with cogent, intelligent analysis of the pertinent facts of the case to demonstrate that the defendant's alleged negligence injured the plaintiff and further caused damage as a result. That is the issue that I respectfully suggest is presented in this case this morning. Now, there is no such evidence in the record in this case, and it is on that basis that the trial court granted the motion for summary judgment. Plaintiff never offered evidence that Hush's advice was wrong. They had a single expert by the name of Tollefson. Mr. Tollefson's testimony is, when you get to this issue of should lawsuit have been filed, that was mentioned in the argument here, his testimony in the record, clearly in the record, is that he didn't believe it mattered one way or the other whether or not a lawsuit was filed. At pages 675 and 676 of the legal file, Mr. Tollefson says, the way I analyze the case, it doesn't matter whether he filed a lawsuit or not. He threatened litigation. That's sufficient.
What about the clarification on reconsideration? Wasn't there some additional expert testimony submitted on reconsideration?
There was. In the motion for reconsideration, Mr. Tollefson filed an affidavit, but he did not change that testimony in any way. The best he ever said was, I think the settlement was done negligently because I would have exercised the options in order to put us in the best possible negotiating position. However, he never went on to in any way testify or offer any evidence of any kind as to how that would have affected the change. And this is where you get to the issue that some courts, and indeed I would say maybe many courts, have used the phrase, and the restatement of torts have used the phrase, restatement of lawyer conduct, not of torts. Restatement third of lawyer conduct. Have used the phrase case within a case. And the argument is that there has to be some expert testimony in order to demonstrate to the finder of fact what could have been done differently that would have improved the situation.
Opposing counsel points out that there was testimony that it was a no-brainer that he breached the contract. Is that a different issue than what you're talking about?
You know, I think it is, Your Honor, because there was an anticipatory breach by what Mr. Mueller did, but where does that get you? Where does that go, an anticipatory breach? So if we'd have filed a lawsuit, if Mr. Nail had wanted to file a lawsuit, and let me assure you that the record is replete with the fact that Mr. Nail was a sophisticated, competent businessman, a CPA, CFO of the Mueller Company, invested in the stock market, engaged in over 20 separate conversations or meetings with our client about strategy. Everything done in this case was decided by Mr. Nail. Now, I'm not trying to say that we don't have responsibility to do the job right. We do, and we did. But whether a lawsuit is filed or not is a decision of Mr. Nail. Whether or not he settles or not, that's the same type of decision. So at the rehearing, Your Honor, nothing really changed. Mr. Tollefson did not appear in court. He appeared by affidavit, and he did not give us any testimony that if the options had been enforced by executing them, it would have changed. In fact, this is in the face of the fact that the negotiations took place with notice to Mr. Mueller's counsel and Mr. Mueller that Mr. Nail intended to exercise the options. That is contained in a two-page letter in the legal file at pages 678 and 679. In a letter from Mr. Carman to Mr. Kevin Murphy representing Mueller, in which he states on page 2, I am writing to give you notice that Mr. Nail has the present intention of to exercise options prior to July 18, 2002. So the negotiations for the settlement that Mr. Nail approved took place in the context of he knows that the options are going to be executed. There is no testimony by Mr. Tolson as to how the settlement would have improved if the options had been executed. Indeed, the settlement itself gave Mr. Nail the benefit of putting the stock in escrow, which was one of the major issues on this plate. He wanted the stock out of the hands of Mr. Mueller, out of his hands. He got that. He got a five-year window to exercise the options, which allowed him to play the market because the market was in flux. Now, lastly, he got $50,000 credit to help him exercise those options, which he eventually did, and sold stock. He obtained over 2 million shares of the TIG stock, which was the British company, which was publicly traded, whereas the company by Mr. Mueller's, that Mr. Mueller owned, was a privately held corporation in this country. So there was no public market. So he obtained a public market. He sold it. He made $600,000. And now comes back and says, well, this settlement could have been better, having made the decision himself, of course. But what he, to follow that to its logical conclusion, we would be required as trial lawyers to look over our shoulder for whatever period the statute of limitations is on any settlement that's done in any case. Now, we have to do it right, but we have to have at least the protection as a legal profession that the other professions have, whether it's medical, architectural, engineering, or whatever it is. And that is, if there is competent, intelligent, cogent, expert testimony that negligence has occurred and it has caused injury and damage, both injury and damage, then we should be held to account. But there has to be some guideline as to how we can be held to account. And it's that expert testimony.
Counsel, you're arguing that expert testimony is required to establish the fact of injury and the fact of damage. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
As opposed to the amount of damages.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Distinguish those two for me.
Of damage?
Yeah. What evidence that establishes the fact of injury does not also establish the fact of some damage?
It will obviously depend on the factual situation presented, but the lawyer's responsibility is to conduct business in a manner as lawyers generally do across the state. That's the standard.
Mm-hmm.
So the testimony of injury needs to be, or causation, needs to be that the lawyer did something affirmatively or failed to do something that obviously should have been considered and done and would have been by a practicing attorney of similar skill and failed to do so, and that as a result of that failure or affirmative action, the plaintiff, the client, mm-hmm. now the plaintiff, is put in a position of damage so that they are injured. So from that point on, then it's, does it cause actual damage? And the amount of the damage, I think, can be established in a different manner. So there are two facets to it that we believe that the cases involving professions require.
And why wasn't there some evidence of the fact of some damage here? Or
because Mr. Tollefson never testified in his deposition and never stated in his affidavit what that damage might have been. In other words, the case within a case, or how would he how would Mr. Nail have been better off? Remember, the only thing that he really complains of, it's not the not filing of a lawsuit, it's you didn't exercise the options first. So we tell them we're going to exercise them. The negotiations take place over a protracted period of time. It's a complex issue, and they settle the case. He never testifies. If you had actually exercised the options, you would have obtained a better settlement. Doesn't say that. That's not in the record. That's the defect in the record that the trial court was faced with and ruled that the plaintiff had not presented sufficient evidence of causation of injury or damage.
But their argument is that at least one of the arguments is that there was evidence that that your lawyer, from your lawyer, that that they misunderstood or misperceived the effect of the stock restrictions, and that that started this cascade of dominoes because they misunderstood the effect of the restrictions, they misunderstood the likely success of a lawsuit, and they underestimated the bargaining strength in negotiations, and on and on. So why are they incorrect that we ought to start there in looking for evidence of injury or damage?
Well, I don't really agree, Your Honor, respectfully, that that's what the record really shows. The transfer of the stock had a problem because they had a one-year lockup. Really didn't have anything to do with the advice given or the damage or cause of damage. That was a fact that the parties were met with when they came to it. So it didn't translate into what we're talking about causation or damage. It's kind of like two different things. It was there, it's in the record, but it's not part of the nexus of what he really complains about, because he got that stock into escrow, even though it had still the one-year lockup on it, which it would expire in July of 2002. I hope that gets you where you...
Can you address the disagreement on the substantial burden test and how that applies here at Williams v. Freeman and so forth?
Yes, I certainly would, Your Honor. Substantial burden is causation. That's what substantial burden is. That's what the Freeman case in court really said when you look at that case, that causation is what has to be proved. Causation of injury, causation of damage. And that's a substantial burden. There's no doubt about it. It needs to be a substantial burden in order to sue professionals, whether they're lawyers or architects or whatever they are.
Is it higher than the normal standard of proof, you're saying, if there's a settlement?
No, I don't think it's higher than the normal standard of proof. I think that is what this court is faced with, deciding what standard of proof is required against a professional in the state of Missouri. And I respectfully suggest that when you look at the courts around the country, when you look at the logic of the Freeman case and the other cases like it, and restatement third, that you'll see that exactly what we've been talking about. It is expert testimony as that there was negligence, that it caused damage, that it caused injury, and that that is the threshold that a plaintiff must show in order to proceed. And that is exactly what this trial court ruled.
Can you address opposing counsel's argument that had they had advice and recognized the allegedly negligent advice they got from Hush, that would be the standard, that standard does not apply where they didn't have independent advice and understand the allegedly negligent conduct by Hush? They're saying Williams v. Preman's standard does not apply here because what they're suing over occurred before they understood what they now allege was negligent advice.
Judge, I'm not sure I understood that. Are you talking about the knowledge of negligence before or after?
Opposing argument is saying the substantial burden test does not apply because it only applies if they had noticed that they'd allegedly gotten negligent advice from Hush.
Okay. I think if I understand that question, Your Honor, I do. I would like to speak to it. It is, first of all, I think the distinction that has been argued that it depends on whether or not the negligence is discovered before or after the settlement is not valid. I don't think that is a legitimate argument. It would establish some type of swinging pendulum rule as to where the negligence might have been known about and present arguments in that context. I don't think it's a valid argument. I think it doesn't matter whether or not, if there is negligence, it's discovered before a settlement or after a settlement. The rule should be the same. There has to be some intelligent, cogent, intellectual, expert testimony to demonstrate the fact of negligence, the causation necessary to prove injury and damage. And I don't think the Preman case really says that. I think the Preman case says simply it's a substantial burden, causation is, and I think the trial court's ruling said exactly the same thing. Causation is a substantial burden.
Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
If there is any doubt in this case about how much damage Mr. Nail suffered, it is because Hush Blackwell helped create that vacuum by failing to tell him to exercise or to file suit to confirm a breach of contract, which would have fixed Mr. Nail's damages.
What evidence was there in the record of damages?
Mr. Tollefson, who we've been told said nothing about this, in his affidavit at page 757 of the legal file says, in their evaluation of Mr. Nail's case, his lawyers failed to recommend Mr. Nail exercise as soon as possible to preserve the value of his damage claim. Mr. Nail should have been told the exercise of the options was virtually riskless. Exercise would have created a breach and fixed the damages at the time of exercise. If the share price rose, he would have been entitled to the gain under an unjust enrichment theory. I mean, that's at the heart of it, Judge. I mean, he was never told to do that. All we ever had was an anticipatory breach. When he's finally told to settle his case, some 9 months after he retains his law firm, by that time the stocks had fallen by 50%. During the additional lockup time that he had between he was told to settle that case and when he was entitled to first exercise under the settlement agreement, it had fallen another 50%. So the question is, was he entitled to $10 million, which would have been the peak value, or $600,000, which was the most he was able to salvage? And was Hush Blackwell contributory to that bad result? And the question undoubtedly is that they were negligent. At least there's evidence in the record of negligence from my expert. From their own people in-house, they've said that lawsuit had merit. So then why are they saying that now when they told Mr. Nail that it had no merit, justifying a great compromise in the value of his lawsuit? And in that sense, it is not unlike I settle a case for a quadriplegic for $100,000 because I tell my client that that's the amount of the State Farm policy, only to find out that there was a $5 million excess policy.
Where is the evidence that they would have gotten the terms of the settlement agreement had they first filed suit or first exercised the option? I mean, they got $50,000 and a five-year extension of the option. They traded that, according to, sounds like, the letters for not exercising the option at the time, which would have put Mr. Mueller in breach, and they said they were going to do that, and instead he settled and gave them a five-year extension of the option. I understand it happens, the market went down later, but why wasn't that just a settlement?
Because by the time that advice was given, Judge, they had been sitting on this for 9 months, and had let a peak price of 4.4 pounds per share dropped to something like 2 pounds per share. It later dropped to below a pound per share. And this is over a year's worth of representation by Hush Blackwell, where they have failed to give him that advice legally about how best to preserve the value of his damages. And any doubt is because of that delay and their advice that basically do nothing. You've got a lawsuit that you can't do anything about practically, so take this 50 cents on the dollar settlement, and even that didn't work.
Now, your client knew something about the market. It was his interest, it was his shares. If he wanted to pursue his interest, why did he let it go on for 9 months? Couldn't he have asserted his interest as a client?
I'm assuming you're getting at the sophisticated kind of client. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I don't know. I don't even do my own taxes. Okay, that's because I don't know the first thing about tax law. To say that Mr. Nail is a sophisticated investor, first off, there isn't a whole lot of evidence in the record that's the case. He's well educated. If that's the extent of his sophistication, fine. There isn't anything in the record that indicates that he knows the first thing about trading shares on the United Kingdom Exchange. So, I mean, he's sophisticated, he's well educated. Is he sophisticated in the context of law or in the context of what he needs to do to preserve his rights on an international merger agreement? There is absolutely no evidence in the record that would reflect this. And I can tell you personally, he's not.
He had 3 months to exercise the option before the sale to the UK company, right? And he didn't do that?
He did not do that, Judge, but that was because he was relying on advice of counsel.
No, before that, from March to July, whenever, or March, before Mueller signed, or at least March
yes,
to
yes. June. Yes, yes. From the time he left the company in March until the company was sold in July, he could have exercised those options at that time. He did not. There wasn't anything that would reflect that they were at risk. It wasn't until the issue arose about the impending sale that, honestly, he got to the point where he said, wait a minute, I wonder if my option agreements are at risk, and that's when he goes to Hush Blackwell. Okay. Unless there are further questions, ladies and gentlemen, I have nothing further to say.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under advisement.